I wonder whether over this Christmas you watched any Christmas films. I spent most of Christmas in a house with 11 other people, so I didn't get any chance to watch any of the Christmas films that I might have enjoyed, although other people in the house watched their Christmas favourites. And very often the films that we watch at Christmas are often the kind of fairy tale Christmas stories, aren't they? We want stories at Christmas especially that have a happy ending. But of course, the film couldn't be happy from the beginning through to the end, could it? That wouldn't be a true fairy tale Christmas story or fairy tale Christmas film. Oh no, what we need is for a fight of good against evil. We need it to look for a time as though evil's going to win. And then just at the last minute, just as we think that that evil has conquered, good then comes and defeats evil once and for all. That's how the fairy tales work. That's how storytelling seems to work the world over. Something in our psyches, perhaps deep in our souls, that seems to not only enjoy that kind of story, but want that kind of story, almost as if we're pre-programmed for it. Well, it's all very well in fairy tales, of course, to have good against evil and good always wins, but what about real life? What about your life and mine? Is that similar, a fight of good against evil? And if it is, does good always win out? Well, in Matthew's Gospel and the story that we read earlier from Matthew chapter 2 of the wise men come in, and then Joseph and Mary having to flee to Egypt after they've gone because of Herod's murderous rage, that story has some of those fairy tale qualities to it, doesn't it? It's certainly a story of good against evil. It's certainly a story where evil is thwarted and good prevails. But it's only the opening chapters, of course. There is much more of the story still to come. And unlike the films and the fairy tales, this is a true story. And it's more than a true story. It's a story that, well, shapes us. It's a story that's part of the greatest story that ever told. It's a story that changed the world. And as a consequence, therefore, we can learn from this story how our own stories might unfold. There's some vital things that we can learn from the story. But before we do, let me just spend a couple of minutes just recapping the story and reminding us of the important parts. As I've mentioned when we read this earlier, the shepherds have already come and visited Mary and Joseph. The wise men, sometime later, have also visited. But of course, on their way to see the child Jesus and to present their gifts, the wise men had called in at Jerusalem at the palace of King Herod. And King Herod was in some ways a very great king. He was called Herod the Great, and yet he was also a vindictive and wicked king. We know that, of course, from the story that we read here. We know that from many other historical sources of his time. He was ruthless, and anyone who even looked as though they might usurp his power did not last long. Herod, of course, had told the wise men, look, when you find this child who's been born, who's going to be king of the Jews, come back and let me know so that I can worship him. He had no intention, of course, of worshiping this child. He simply wanted to know who he was and where he was. But the wise men had been spoken to. We can read that in verses 13 and following. The wise men therefore departed, and Herod had been tricked. Verse 16. He was furious about that, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under. It's probable, therefore, that the wise men perhaps visited Jesus, you would think, maybe a year or so after Jesus had been born. They had a long journey, of course, from the east, many hundreds of miles that they had to take on foot. Herod, wanting to make no mistakes, gives a very wide margin of error to make sure he absolutely, definitely is going to make sure this baby doesn't survive. It's a terrible, wicked thing to do. And Jesus, of course, survives the onslaught. He survives because prior to that, Joseph has been spoken to in a dream. He rises up, he takes the child and his mother, and he flees into Egypt. Historically, Egypt has been an enemy of God's people, but here Egypt is the place where God's son is kept safe. And he stays there, verse 15, until the death of Herod. There's a degree of irony here, of course, isn't there? Herod is wanting Jesus to be dead, but it's Herod, of course, who dies first, actually just a few years after this story unfolds. Jumping down to verse 19, Herod then, as I've said, dies. An angel then appears to Joseph again in the dream, this time in Egypt. It's safe to go back now. He goes back. Those who sought the child's life are dead, verse 20. He goes back and returns to the land of Israel. Quick historical footnote. I said that Herod was Herod the Great. He was also rather paranoid, and anybody who looked like he might take his authority, he did away with. That might be all very well in life, but it doesn't go for a very successful succession plan. There isn't somebody who is ready to take and to follow on in Herod's way. Also, at this time, the Roman Empire has spread to the land of Israel. Herod really is a king under the Roman emperor himself, and the king, therefore, is appointed by the emperor. It's not simply, you can't simply assume it'll be the oldest son of the existing king. So what happens? The emperor has no confidence in Herod's sons. The most promising of Herod's sons have been killed off by Herod in the past. So he divides his kingdom, Herod's kingdom, into little segments. And the king who ruled over Jerusalem and over Bethlehem was as wicked as his father was, if not worse. He only survived a few years before the emperor realized what a mistake it had been to appoint him and got rid of him. But up in the north in Galilee, there's another ruler up there who seems to be a more generous and well-intentioned king. And so the family, rather than settling back into Bethlehem, go back up north to Galilee and settle there in Nazareth. That's the story as we've read it. But, of course, with every story from the Bible, there are reasons behind the story, things that we're to learn from the story. And there are four things in particular that I feel are vital to us this evening and will be a great help to us as we look at our own stories and how they might unfold. Here's the first lesson that we can learn from this story. It's this: Satan comes to kill and destroy. Satan comes to kill and destroy. We talked earlier about those fairy tale Christmas movies of good against evil, and we made reference to the fact that this story feels a little bit like this. It's a true story, of course, but nonetheless, there's very much a story of good against evil. And just like many of those Christmas movies, the good is the underdog, the evil is the powerful one. And we get a sense of that here, don't we? This great king, Herod the Great, the powerful ruler, seeking to devour this child. He's seeking to destroy him. You can see that word in verse 13, to search for the child, to destroy him. Now behind Herod, there is a spiritual dimension. Indeed, there's a spiritual dimension to all aspects of human history and our lives. And although it's perfectly right to say it was Herod who sought out Jesus. It was Herod who had these babies ordered to be killed. At the very same time, we can see from the rest of what Scripture teaches us that behind Herod was Satan himself. Satan, who wanted ultimately to destroy the Christ child because he had some idea, a better idea than Herod, of what this child might grow into. Let me read a passage from the book of Revelation that might help us understand this a little better. Now, Revelation is a strange book of the Bible. It's Revelation chapter 12 I'm going to read. It's a book of the Bible that's full of prophecies. And those prophecies are told in picture language. So what the book of Revelation does is it uses pictures to tell us a truth. But we're not to think of the prophecies in Revelation as being fulfilled absolutely literally. There's all kinds of images in the book of Revelation that you can't even visualize. They kind of don't make sense visually of crowns and multi-headed beasts and horns and all sorts of things that you can't visualize. But the pictures mean something. And you'll see that as we read from Revelation chapter 12. You get the same story that we've read in Matthew chapter 2, but from a different perspective. You might almost say from a heavenly perspective. A great sign, we read Revelation chapter 12, verse 1, appeared in heaven. You might think of perhaps the Star of Bethlehem as you're thinking about the great sign appearing in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, these 12 stars represent the 12 tribes of Israel, the nation of Israel, in other words. This woman is the nation of Israel. Jesus, of course, being born as a part of that nation. He is a Jew, of course. This woman, verse 2, was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems or crowns. His tail swept down a third of the stars in heaven and cast them to earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. Do you see the picture? We know from verse 9, if I could just skip ahead for a moment to Revelation 12 of verse 9, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. So if you have any doubt as to who the book of Revelation, this dragon, this picture of the dragon is talking about, it's the devil himself. So we have this picture, don't we, of the devil there waiting. He's heard, as it were, that the prophecies that have been given in the Bible, he knows all about them. Perhaps he's overheard or heard about the prophecies that have been given to Elizabeth and to Mary. Perhaps he's heard what the shepherds have been saying, what the angels have said, and so on. He knows what this child represents, and he is eager to devour this child. Verse 5 of Revelation 12, she gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. The rod is a symbol of power. If you see, for example, pictures from Egypt of the Pharaoh, you know which one's the Pharaoh because he's the one with the rod. And the same with the Assyrian kings and other kings of the area. The king is the one with the rod. Normally the rods would be made of wood, a wooden rod, but this is a rod of iron. Iron, of course, being much stronger than wood. So here's one who's going to rule powerfully. That's part of what the picture is represented. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. In other words, rescued from the dragon. You see, as we look at this story in Matthew chapter 2, we can look at the story of a wicked, power-hungry, crazed, paranoid king who, wanting to keep power to himself, was prepared to do anything. And that, of course, is an absolutely correct way of reading what happened. Or we can read it in the way that Revelation 12 reads it, that there's something deeper than a mere king, but there's a spiritual battle involved. There's Satan, who is coming to kill and destroy. And like Herod, but much more so, he will do anything to get his way. And Satan comes to kill and destroy. That's his modus operandi. That's how he works. And of course, Satan is not a myth. He would love you to believe that. It's one of the reasons, of course, why you often see pictures of devils looking rather odd with the horns and the fork and the tail and the little forked rod, as it were. It's almost a cute and a silly picture. That's not what the devil looks like. If the devil looks like anything at all, that's a childish imitation. But there is a spiritual world. There is a world of good and evil, a world that we cannot see, but is real nonetheless. And behind that which we can see is a spiritual world of which we can be aware, a spiritual world which interacts with our own, and a spiritual world which influences this world of ours. We'll say more about that influence a little bit later. But what we need to know here, that here is Satan, who is destructive and violent and wicked and, of course, therefore, dangerous. Satan comes to kill and destroy. But there's something else that we can learn from Matthew chapter 2, and that's Jesus comes to heal and to save. Jesus comes to heal and to save. He is the very opposite, in other words, of Satan. Now, you might be wondering here, I don't see very much about Jesus coming to heal and to save in the passage that we read. You might say, well, I see that in other passages. We read about it recently in Matthew chapter 1. We'll see it as we go through Matthew's gospel. I know that Jesus came to heal and save, you might say, but where is it in the passage that we read? Well, it is hidden. It is subtle. Matthew has his own way of painting pictures that will help us to see something more deeply, perhaps, than we might see at first glance. You see, to us, the Christmas story is incredibly well known, isn't it? You only have to mention some little parts of the Christmas story, and we all know what's being spoken of. If we talked about, for example, an angel on a tree, we'd all think of Christmas. If we spoke of a manger or in a stable, we'd all think of Christmas. If we spoke about a guiding star, we'd think of Christmas. We only need these tiny little words and phrases, and because they're so well known, we immediately think of the Christmas story. And it was like that, of course, not just for our own culture, but for all cultures. All cultures have their well-known stories. And for the Jews that Matthew was writing to in the first century, their well-known story was not yet Christmas. Christmas was too new. Their well-known story was the Exodus, at the time when God rescued his people out of Egypt, and he brought them through the Red Sea, and ultimately using Moses into the Promised Land. And just as we can talk about shepherds and wise men, and you all immediately know what I'm talking about, so too Matthew could use these little words and phrases, and all of his readers' minds would go back to that great story of God redeeming and rescuing his people out of Egypt and taking them to the Promised Land. And he does that in several ways in Matthew chapter 2. We don't have time to mention them all, but the most obvious one, of course, is by mentioning Egypt repeatedly, because that's where this story revolves around. In verse 13, Joseph takes the child and his mother and flees to Egypt. Egypt is repeated again in verse 14. He departed to Egypt. It's repeated again in verse 15. Out of Egypt I called my son. In verse 19, Egypt is repeated once again. The Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. Egypt is really important in this story, mentioned those four times. And of course, that Exodus story took place from Egypt. But it's not just that. There is more than that. The reference in verse 15 to the prophecy, "Out of Egypt I called my son." If you were to look that up in Hosea chapter 11, you'd discover that doesn't appear actually to be a prophecy about the Messiah to come. It appears instead to be an historical account of what God has already done. When we read Hosea chapter 11 and verse 1, we discover that the Son is not the Son of God, Jesus Christ, in the original context. The Son is the nation of Israel. Because actually God described the whole nation of Israel as his son from time to time, including in Hosea. So Hosea 11 verse 1 that's quoted here speaks explicitly of the Exodus. And there's more too, because when we read about Herod's death in verses 19 and 20, it would be very reminiscent of another passage in the Bible, if our ears were attuned as Matthew's readers were. Let me read verses 19 and 20 to you. "But when Herod died, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, 'Rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead.'" And in the book of Exodus, there's a very similar story that unfolds for us, because Moses has had to flee Egypt too. Do you remember, some of you, that early on in Moses' life, he killed a man, he had to flee away from Egypt, but later he could return to Egypt because the Pharaoh was dead. Do you remember that? It's in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 19. "The Lord said to Moses in Midian, 'Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead.'" Does that sound familiar? It's almost what we've just read, isn't it? "So Moses took his wife and his sons," very similar to what we've just read, "put them on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt." And in describing the story in this way, Matthew is wanting us to think, and wanting his readers to think, of that original Exodus story with Moses. And it helps us to understand, you see, something deeper of who Jesus is. Because what happened in that original Exodus story was that God rescued his people from slavery in Egypt. He rescued them from their bondage. He freed them by taking them through the Red Sea. The Red Sea, of course, crashed down behind them, so there was no return back to Egypt. At the same time, nobody from Egypt could pursue them any longer, and eventually took them into the Promised Land. And Matthew is saying to us subtly here is, well, that's what Jesus is doing. Just as the story of the Exodus began in this way, so too does Jesus's story begin in this way. But if you've been paying attention, you'll realize that what's happening to Jesus is the very opposite of what happened with Moses. Moses had to flee from Egypt, but Jesus is fleeing to Egypt. The opposite is happening. What does this mean? It means two things. It means, firstly, that the one who should be king over the Lord's people, Herod, is actually not on the Lord's side at all, but on the side of Satan, as Pharaoh was in the Old Testament. That's the first thing, that Israel is not the land where people are truly worshipping God and following him. It means also that Jesus is kind of almost undoing and reversing what the people have done. He's doing everything backwards. It's a little bit like watching a videotape and then rewinding it, and everything goes back and becomes undone. But this time, when Matthew, as it were, in chapter 2, presses play for the second time, it's a different story that's going to unfold. Because that first rescue, that one out of Egypt, where they eventually ended up in the Promised Land, there was oh so many failures on the way. the people rebelled against God. And of those original people who left Egypt, only a tiny handful actually made it to the promised land. Not even Moses himself made it. For future generations, it was a success, but for that generation, it was a failure. But when Matthew presses play on his video, as it were, to replay the story works out in an entirely different way. So chapter 4, for example, of Matthew's Gospel, which we'll be looking at in a few weeks' time, is Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days. And you might remember that as God's people left Egypt, they spent 40 years in the wilderness, going round and round in circles, failing again and again and again to put their trust in God. And yet when Jesus spends his time in the wilderness, he fights the devil and his temptation. He succeeds against him. He does not fall. Jesus succeeds where they have failed. You see, Jesus comes to heal and to save. The tape is rewound, and when play is pressed again, Jesus will do what God's people have failed to do. And that's shown in the big picture. It's shown in the details of Jesus' life later on. And he didn't just do what the Israelites failed to do, but Jesus' life is doing what you and I have failed to do. Principally, to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. That's what God requires of you and of me. And I fail to do that. And you fail to do that. But as we turn the pages of Matthew's Gospel, we'll find on page after page after page, Jesus really is loving the Lord his God with all his heart, mind, soul, and strength. He's loving his neighbor as himself. Jesus, as play was pressed, we see doing all the things that you and I have failed to do. And in so doing, he can reap the rewards that you and I have let go. He comes to heal and to save. He represents us, therefore. This is, in some ways, a fairy tale, a true fairy tale, but a fairy tale nonetheless. We can't complete the fairy tale. We can't get to the end, but Jesus can and did. He comes, you see, to heal and to save. Which leads us on to the third thing that we can learn. We've seen that Satan comes to kill and destroy, and Jesus comes to heal and to save. Thirdly now, each of us must choose. Each of us must choose. Because we shouldn't see this story as a great spiritual battle somehow divorced from the actions of ordinary people. We shouldn't even see it as something that happens at the realm of the power brokers and the kings and the emperors of this world. Because as this story unfolds, it's the ordinary person in the story, the only ordinary person in the story, in a sense, Joseph, who is key to all this. It is Joseph who is spoken to by the angel. It is Joseph who gets his family together and saves them from Herod's murderous threats. It is Joseph who hears that Herod has died and takes his family back to Galilee, where Jesus can eventually begin his ministry. Joseph, just an ordinary, everyday peasant, very probably, or carpenter, as you know, just an ordinary person. And yet it is through him that all of this unfolds. Joseph, you see, has chosen his side. He is not going to follow Satan with his death and destruction, but he's going to follow God, his heavenly Father, and ultimately serve Jesus of Nazareth. The wise men too, of course, they have chosen their side. They too have rejected Satan and his vicious attacks. They too have chosen to serve and worship Jesus the Christ. And that, of course, means that us today have to make that same choice. We have to choose today whom we will serve. And it's a binary choice. You might wonder, why on earth would anyone choose the devil? I know there are some people who worship the devil very explicitly. I'm not suggesting that that anyone here would want to do that. But I am saying that some of what the devil represents can be very attractive. He represents ourselves, and particularly our self-interests. At least that's what he is. All he cares about, though, is himself. But those of us who are prone to self-centeredness and to looking after number one, we're naturally drawn, therefore, to follow him and to do the things that he does, maybe to a lesser degree. We're not as powerful as he. Obviously, we have perhaps more of God's grace working in our lives than he does. But nonetheless, we follow him. And it seems in many ways so attractive, seeking pleasure for self. And yet, remember Satan? Ultimately, he comes to kill and destroy. Satan is like those teenagers or young people who steal your car only to take it on what they call a joyride. To bring pleasure, but ultimately what happens? The car is driven round. Great risk to other people, get plenty of knocks and bangs on the way, and will eventually end up on some wasteland somewhere where, having had their fun, they'll chuck in their match and the car will be destroyed and gone. That's how Satan loves to work. He toys with us, plays with us, gives us pleasure for a short while, but then he's done and he leaves just an empty shell. We need to choose this day whom we will serve. Surely the one who has come to save and heal and redeem, the one who has come to live the life that we could never live, surely he's the one that we would want to serve. He's the one to whom we should bow the knee. But too many times our own hearts cry out, self, self, self. We don't want to bow the knee to any authority over us, even a good king like Jesus. And yet those of you who this evening have indeed bowed the knee to Jesus Christ will be able to say with me and with every other Christian that there is no one else in whom we would rather serve than Jesus, because he has never let us down and he has done everything good and he has always worked to our best interests. And he has given his very self for us as he died for us on the cross. So Satan comes to kill and destroy. Jesus comes to heal and to save. Each of us must choose. Fourthly, finally, in all of this, God is in control. You see what happens in those fairy tales, isn't it? Those films we see. There comes a moment in the film, in the story, when the hero of the story is out of control. They're not able to stop the bad things that are happening. They're doing their best, but evil is getting the upper hand. And very often they need some kind of almost miraculous intervention to be able to get things back on track. But that's not the case in this story. This is never out of God's control. We see it very clearly that even when these terrible things are happening, even when the male children in Bethlehem who were under 2 years old or under have been killed, what do we read in verse 17? Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah of the weeping and loud lamentation. You see, all this that happened, even the things that Satan brought about, even the great wickedness of Herod, even this, somehow in the mystery and the providence of God, is not outside of God's control. And in it he overrules. And in it he works his purposes out. And in it, at the end, his Son, our Savior, is safe and free to live the life that we could never live, so that when the time is right, he can die the death that we deserve. Sometimes it may feel as though evil is winning and God has lost control. It would have felt like that, no doubt, to Joseph and perhaps to the wise men and to others who were looking on that day. But it was never the case. It is never the case. However difficult and dark your life is, however this world of ours is in turmoil, there is never a time when God loses control. There is never a time when God is not working his purposes out. Because he is all powerful and he conquers all. Satan comes to kill and destroy. Jesus comes to heal and to save. Each of us must choose. In all this, God is in control. Where are you this evening? Whom are you following? Have you bowed the knee to Jesus Christ? Have you recognized that when he came to this world, he came not just to save sinners in an abstract sense, but do you believe he came to save you? He came to save me. This is just the beginning of the story, but already it's a wonderful opening to a life that is lived for us. Let's worship the one who came to this world for our sakes.